The organisers asked me to specifically talk on the new digital imaging technologies, and so that's what I've done for the last 2 hours. But they didn't want to talk for 3 hours on that, but for some of the people here, they realised I could have talked for 3 hours on it. So they said, could you please add also some useful radiology information? And your colleague, Dr. Werf, has elected to talk about thoracic radiology, so that immediately took away the thing I wanted to talk about, because that, I think, is the hardest area that we use radiographs for. So she's spent 2 hours today doing that. This evening, beginning at 6, we have cases for you to challenge you, and we have more thoraxes in there. And so I have some thoraxes too, as well as other things. I picked another subject that I have always had some interest in, and that is radiology of the small bones of the back specifically, and also seeing how veterinarians who send radiographs for a second opinion make them, have also some input, I think, to you to improve then the quality of these radiographs and help you look more specifically for certain things on them. Now, my previous two sessions were about digital radiology, and one of the reasons I see that veterinarians spend the money to get digital radiology is to get better quality to their images, because they don't think their images look like the book's radiographs, the textbook radiographs. In getting images from veterinarians, I see that I estimate more than 50% of them have been significantly downgraded because of the darkroom procedures that were performed to process the film. So the most single common place where the film gets ruined is in the darkroom. And I serve on the Vet School Admission Committee, and virtually all the applicants tell us as teenagers how they worked in vet practice and how many radiographs they developed all the time. And so I think a lot of them are being done by fairly inexperienced people, and the darkroom is not being managed optimally, and quality control is an issue. And by getting an automatic processor, that will fix all the problems. Unfortunately, no, it doesn't. They need to be serviced. They go out of calibration with temperature. And another problem that you need to be aware of in a small volume practice situation is they're designed for human imaging, where they run at least 60 human chest radiographs per day through them. And so these automatic processors pump in new chemistry per inch of film run through them. So if you're only making, say, 5 or 7 or 10 radiographs a day, you need to ask the tech to run another 50 blank pieces of film through the processor that day to get the right amount of chemicals into the processor, so that the what's called the replenishment rate of the chemistry that goes into the processor needs to be adjusted to the volume of films being run through the processor. And people who are just dealing with the veterinary marketplace know that, and they know how to adjust the machines. But if you're just getting them delivered from a human vendor, or being maintained by a human vendor, such as Mary X-Ray, which does ours out of Denver and does a lot of them across the country, they don't ever ask us about replenishment rates. And we purposefully have called Kodak and had them come out and adjust them appropriately. Because in winter, in our second processor for horses, we weren't running that number of films. And this is what would happen, is the films would go whiter. Oh, we've underexposed it. We need to increase the exposure, make it darker. Yes, increasing exposure will make it darker, definitely. And then we'll see the spine better, and we'll see the horse leg better. I made this photograph, digital image, by holding some fingers behind the film and the light box. And do you see how obvious my fingers are stopping the light? Go home, have a look at your films where there's just black film around a fairly thick-sized dog. You shouldn't be able to see your fingers. You shouldn't be able to see if you need to cut your fingernails. Okay? It should be jet black. And that comes from the development. And so what happens is, over time, we get less development. The film goes grayer. You can see it along the top there. It's not black, it's gray. And the patient goes whiter, so we blame the X-ray machine, where in fact we're just underdeveloping the films. So this is a very easy, quick test. Hold the film up with your fingers in front of the viewbox, and any don't do this to a bird's wing, okay? To a reasonable-sized animal that needed radiation that would make the film go completely black, and you shouldn't see your fingers through the light, from the light, because the film's black enough. Okay, so, and I put these in the notes for you. Underdevelopment. This is the most single common problem I see. The possibilities are we have old developer that's become either oxidized or exhausted because we haven't changed it frequently enough in deep tanks, but in an automatic processor, we aren't pumping enough in because we aren't running the minimum number of films recommended per day, 14, 17-inch size films as per humans. The other possibility that I've seen occur also is the temperature circuit goes on the blink, and this chemistry is normally heated to like 95 degrees Fahrenheit, like a tropical fish tank, and suddenly that becomes unreliable, inaccurate, or the cold water coming into the processor during winter gets so just close to freezing that the poor machine's heating all the time and still can never heat it up enough. So you need to know how to take the temperature of your developer solution, even in an automatic processor. The best ones have a temperature dial on the outside that show you the temperature all the time, an indicator where it should be. So replace the developer solution, automatic processors, increase the replenishment amount, and check temperatures. Next thing that will make the film gray and not so nice is what we call fog, where we don't have the whites available to us on the film because they never were able to be made clear film. And the one place that always tips me off about this is to look where the blocker is, where the radiation blocker is with the label. Usually on most blocker systems, there will be a place where the printed part doesn't cover the entire blocker on purpose. And if you look at that, it should be clear and you should almost be able to see through it. It should be white. If this has gone gray like you're seeing here, then we call this fogging. It's not radiation fog in the cassette because the block is protecting it. It can be radiation, chemical, or other fog when it's in the box of film because then it's not protected by the blocker. Does that make sense? So there are multiple sites where this can occur. So this is the widest the film can possibly get. So our bones then fade into the background because we can't get white bones. There's no white on the film. So if you have really old film, it goes fogged anyway. If you have a dark room where you can see things in when it's got no lights on apart from the safe light, then you don't have a dark room and the film sees the same light. So I suggest next time going into the dark room, if you haven't been in there for quite a while, and then purposefully turning off the safe light and see how really black it really is in there. Should be completely black. If you have the incorrect safe light or the incorrect safe light bulb wattage for the film you're using, that will also fog the film. Less commonly, overdevelopment can do that, but that's usually uncommon unless someone gets things way out of whack or the processor overheats. So old expired film, beware of really cheap specials in the catalogue of film. You get it and you realize you only got a month to use it, and that's why it was cheap. Just like, you know, close to expired food date in grocery stores, they want to move it out quick at a discounted price. Well, film has expiration dates. Safe light off, darkroom should completely black. And also things like wrong light there. Now, the other thing that also makes a fog, we call radiation fog, again, when bones don't stand out, but the light blocker will still have white areas on it because we have lead in the light blocker, is when we have a lot of scattered radiation. And remember, we use the X-ray grid to remove the scattered radiation. We We put the cassette underneath the table where the grid is built into the table, or occasionally maybe strap it on top of it in that situation. So for spinal radiography, I like to use it at thicknesses of 8 centimeters and thicker to use the grid tray, because you want to get the optimum highest contrast you can, and you want to get rid of any of that scatter that's getting through there. So this is where the grid is in the table here. It removes the radiation by using the lead lines, but the amount of scatter you get is proportionate to how big an area of patient you irradiated. So if you've decided you're only going to radiograph the spine, then collimate in to the spine. That's really good for a couple of reasons. It will give less radiation to the film, and so you'll get a better quality image. If you're holding the patient or your techs or anyone else, or all these teenager pre-vet school applicants are holding the animals, they tell me about, then you'll protect them more from the scattered radiation by having less scatter occur. So try and collimate in, especially if you're only interested in the spine. The next thing that will also help the picture is to lower the KVP, because that actually results in higher contrast to bone imaging. And so for bone imaging, now we're trying to see these small, small bones. Here's a KVP in the 80s, and here's one in the 60s. And to me, the bony detail and the clarity of how you of things stand out is much clearer with the lower KVP. Does lowering the KVP have require you to do anything else in driving the X-ray machine? You have to raise the MAS rate and therefore raise the time. So we'll need to handle that, and I have an opinion on that soon. So in collimating down then into these small areas, then you can also improve the contrast and the detail on the image. You save film also if you're using film. To use the second half of the film, use a piece of lead to cover the other half you didn't use, and then switch it around. And then you get two pictures on the price of one sheet of film, right? I don't know how you charge your owners. Is it per exposure or per film? I guess you need to work that out, eh? This is one of the disadvantages of DR plate technology. You only can get one picture every time you press the button. You can't save half the plate for the second picture. With computed radiology, you can do exactly the same and get multiple pictures on the same, as long as they're of the same anatomical region. So here's a piece of lead rubber covering the plate to use it twice. And then the worst thing that ruins the clarity and detail is patient motion. And here is an animal that's blurry because there was movement, respiration occurring during the exposure. So therefore you need to watch respiration and also sometimes decide to control respiration with anesthesia. So poor detail, patient motion is the big one. Scattered radiation also before we reduce the detail. Really high and fast intensifying screens won't make quite as nice as pictures. Also old intensifying screens aren't so good. And with digital imaging, the detailers depend on the MAS you use, the exposure dose you use, and so you can improve it somewhat, though it will never be good as excellent film, by using a higher radiation exposure. White artifacts come from film screen technology, from typically dirt in intensifying screens on the left, so they need to be cleaned. This is actually a digital image, magnified greatly, where there was dirt specks on the CR plate, and it makes the same artifacts, and they have to be cleaned also. Versus this one being scratched by the film processor, making all these sorts of white artifacts. So you'll need to clean things, depending on the technology you're using, to sometimes get rid of these sorts of things. And there's a whole bunch of stuff right there that's also in your notes too. And then, I have no idea what happened here. I was looking through to collect some of these from our artifact file, because they're not part of our normal practice, and I came across this cervical spine. And it was all sorts of different colors and wavy lines and everything else, so I have no idea what happened, apart from maybe two films got stuck together and there was all sorts of chemistry stuck on it. There certainly was grainy white stuff like sediment on there. And so there's a weird one. Questions then about some simple, forward, straightforward technique things. Yes? I believe, from what the manufacturers always say, it's just how old they are. Since they mixed up that brew of chemicals to get the molecules to combine to make the fluorescent materials. So I think it's just time. Yes? Definitely enough that I didn't ever see that gray business. Is the first question. Are you seeing the gray business, is the question? Okay. Then you need to get to the specification or have somebody tell you the specification. And what you usually find is they will tell you how many 14, 17 films, standard human radiology, need to be run through the processor per day for a set replenishment rate. And typically, Kodak, I remember it being 60 mils per film, and then therefore multiply it by the right amount, how many liters would be used then during that day. And then Kodak nicely told you if you're only running 40 or only running 20, you needed to adjust the volume going in by the pump control to higher levels. Another problem also that I found in private practice with an automatic processor when we first installed it and not doing any more than about 5 radiographic studies a day is they gave us a great big 20-gallon tank to put the developer in. And by the time we had used the first 20 gallons of it, it was all this dark brown color, which is what happens with oxidized developer. So then we got a little small 5-gallon container, and when it was almost empty, it was just a touch yellow in color, different than when we first mixed it up. So look at the color in your vat, and it should be like very light yellow honey color, not a darker brown color. In that case, it's just oxidizing in the vat by the air before it even gets into the pump, and so you need a smaller container. Yes? Do they go away on the day after, or are they still there the day after? Okay, check that first. I remember the first processor I ever worked with, and it told you each night to take off what was called the guide shoes that moved it from the three tanks. Take them out of the processor and wipe off any residue chemistry on the curves there and put them back next day. So that every night, the dried little specks of chemistry were cleaned off. So I would suggest, see what happens the day after they go. And then if it's not there, they're doing what they need to do, but you just need to find out what it is that you need to do more frequently. Things can wear out and rollers can get out of skew and they can pull the film inappropriately and scratch it constantly. But if it's changing, yep, they roll the lines. And the issue is, do they go away once they do whatever they do? Or are they there constantly? Kodak processors last forever, but we find about every 15 years they have to be totally rebuilt with totally new rollers, because they gradually get warped and worn. And so they don't really last forever, but they're the ones we have are rebuildable. Any other questions or puzzlements? Okay. So, as I've said, I like a low KVP and a grid. And you correctly said, well, that means you'll need a higher MAS exposure. Then, if the spine and skull is really important to you to get as much radiographic information from as possible, then I really think you need to go to the trouble of either very heavy sedation or general anesthesia to get those high-quality radiographs. Now, this doesn't have to be gaseous anesthesia because it may only be a 10-minute procedure. Here's the tubes in the stog, but it depends on your preference. IV can work just fine. We do this in ultrasound all the time for biopsies, get 10 minutes worth of basically a very deep sedation to light anesthesia to allow us to get the positioning where we want it and a slow respiration rate so they're nice and still and they don't move. Plus, it allows everyone to leave the x-ray room because we can use some sandbags, tape, other ropes, whatever you like, to position the legs and head and other parts without holding the animal as well. So I have my armamentarium of things I want when I go in to do spinal radiology, and that is I want some wedge-shaped sponges to prop up the dog on its sternum. I want some ball cotton to pad under the low places so I can't see it on the radiograph. I want some sandbags, as you saw, to hold the legs in place. For positioning the animals on their back, I use a foam V trough so that they're held on their back, without people having to hold them there. Suggestion, if you haven't done this before and buy one of these, you want to put in a big trash bag because if someone urinates or something into it, you never can get it clean and de-smelled or anything else again, and dirt gets into them as well. So it's in a trash bag. And then I also have a thing called a backboard, which I use for critical care patients that have suspect fractures to their back. The whole concept then is that when we lay our animal on this flat, hard table, they're going to conform to that, like you see over here, and they're going to fall down and roll to this. To get a true image of the spine, we need to get the spine parallel to the tabletop, so we need to pad up all the low spots and radiograph through those with foam or ball cotton, and also rotate the animal, especially deep-chested animals, so that their sternum is lifted up to get their axial rotation so their ribs are superimposed upon each other as well. So that's why I need all these bits and pieces to position them there. Now, there's also another thing that we need to be aware of when we're assessing the widths of intervertebral disc spaces. The x-ray beams coming from our point source in our x-ray tube and then spreading out, diverging. So if you use a long length of it over a long length of spine and the spine is parallel to the tabletop, you'll get the gap between the vertebra being the intervertebral disc space truly represented in the center, but as you get to the ends of the film, the intervertebral disc space will get narrower and narrower and seem to disappear. And that's just because of projection through the disc spaces by the diverging beam. So that here then is a long length of film, and you can see the disc spaces in the center are wide, but as you get to each end, they seem to have collapsed. No, that's not real collapse, that's just because of the x-ray beam effect. So therefore, it's more preferential to, instead of making this on one long length of film, divide this into half and position in the cranial half place up in here, and then move more cordially so that then you can get true representation of the discs because the beam is centered over the ones as you move down the spine. So again, to divide the film into smaller lengths as well as smaller widths. So here we are in the lateral position, and here's another technique that also has some application in the cervical spine, and that is to actually apply a little tension to the spine just prior to making the radiograph. My preference is to let go and step back at the time of making the radiograph because this will stretch out the muscles and align things for you as well. Plus, you see the sponge rubber under the center point here supporting the neck in the center here. So some padding underneath, a little bit of stretch to stretch things out, and palpate the spine in here and center right on it. Now, one comment about the first area to look at is the atlantoaxial junction. Here are the two wings of the atlas C1. And hidden by them is the dens or odontoid process. So on a lateral view, I don't expect to see the dens visible in a normal dog. I do expect that the lamina between C1 and C2 should be really close together. So in a close-up there, I see the wings, and I see the floor of C2. I see only a short gap here, but I don't see the dens or odontoid process because it's hidden below the density of the wings of the atlas. To get to see it, what you need to do is to oblique the skull just like you oblique it for seeing one middle ear. So you rotationally twist the skull by about 30 degrees. So now one middle ear stands out separate from the other. And what you have done is spread the wings of the atlas from top to bottom. And now you can trace the dens through C1 and see it clearly. So if you have a concern that you may have one of those dogs, miniature dogs, that has an lanteo-axial instability, or a trauma dog that has a fracture there, this is the trick to be able to see it on your radiograph. In very thick, muscly dogs that have a thin neck, the worst examples like that Doberman that was laying on the table, really thick shoulders, really thin neck, humans have this huge problem as well. To see the lower cervical and cervical thoracic junction in those dogs, you're going to need to make a second exposure with much more radiation to get through that extra area. And at the same time, what I'd recommend to you is you separate the legs a little bit so that one scapula is more forward and one's more caudally, and that will also spread out the radiation density a bit so they don't all, the spines don't overlap each other. Ventrodorsal view, again, this stretch just before the image. This image looks like the person's holding it for the radiograph. Yeah, you can do that, but if you use a trough and a chemical restraint like you see on the radiograph, because I see an endotracheal tube there, that's not necessary. Again, to look at the atlanteo axial junction here, these are actually synovial joints. There's no disc at occipital condyle, C1, and C1, C2. You never see the dens nearly as well, though, as you do on the lateral view, so that twisted lateral view is the trick to see that odontoid dens process. To evaluate the disc width, again, of big-chested dogs, deep-chested dogs, what happens is when you lay them on their back like this, you see how the spine raises above the table, so it's at a slope already to the table, it's not parallel. And the disc spaces on this drawing are actually sloping in a dog, deep-chested dog such as this Dobie here, actually caudally. So the technique that's described to be able to see through these disc spaces at the cervical thoracic junction here is actually to angle the X-ray tube approximately 15 degrees craniad to get parallel to those discs there, if you wish to see them on the ventrodorsal view accurately. Thoracic area, I just made one long film there. Dogs' thoracic spines, apart from occasionally aplasias, seem to do pretty good. Their discs, you know, are protected by the extra thickening of the intercapital ligament, so it's really uncommon to see a significant disc neurological syndrome between T1-2 disc and T8-9 disc. They certainly can collapse and narrow, but the intercapital ligament there protects the spinal cord from compression. But more caudally, and at the thoracolumbar junction, is the peak of the bell curve in chondrodysplasts for disc disease. So in that situation, with that clinical symptomology, we want to look really closely right at that area and center on the CT junction and the caudal thoracic region. There's one thing also to be aware of, and that's what's called the anticlinal vertebra. And that's judged by when the dorsal processes stop sloping caudally and start sloping cranially. And at this particular dog, it's at a junction between T12, 11, 10. So it's T10, 11. That's most common, but I've seen them also at 9, 10, and 11, 12. And interestingly, I don't know why, no one's ever explained to me, if you look at the intervertebral disc space width right here at this anticlinal junction, it will often be narrower than the disc before or after it. But usually, that area is still protected. It's about the last one by the intercapital ligament. And so I observe it, and if it's the anticlinal one, I tend to discount it if I can find another site for a disc issue. The VD thoracic area is a real tough area because of the changing densities here between the lungs, the heart, and the diaphragm, and also the superimposition of the sternum. In this case, it's very, very slightly rotated, so the sternum's off to the side here. I think it's more luck than planning, you know. It looks pretty ventrodorsal because the dorsal spinous processes are lined up perfectly in the center as very small radiodense objects. But to be honest, you can't do one of these long survey films. I rely on the lateral view to guide me where to go back and get the ventrodorsal view and to optimize the technique, because it's over the heart, it's over the lungs, it's over the liver, and take that approach. If you have digital imaging, this is definitely an advantage because the latitude is much greater and you can get it all on one and then go back and manually optimize that region for its contrast to see it without making any more exposures. Lumbar area, same situation. We need to pad up the sternum because of the fact that the sternum will be rolling downwards. Also, in anything but a cylindrical type dachshund, one of those really fat, you know, they're as round, they measure the same laterally as they do ventrodorsally. I want to pad up the mid-lumbar area with some ball cotton so that it doesn't slump down like this, so that I get true visualization of the disc spaces. These are the intervertebral disc foramens, and they're the only place in the dog, apart from C2-3, where you can see directly through them. And we rely on this, of course, looking for mineralized disc material in the vertebral canal. But unfortunately, when you get up to the thoracic or lumbar junction and cranial to that, the ribs overlap over the top of them, and you can't see that disc material like you would like to on a straight lateral. That same obliqueness is needed also for the ventrodorsal image of the lumbosacral spine, because that disc space, if you look on the lateral view, actually slopes somewhat caudally. And so to image it, and it's a wide disc space, but normally you'll observe it's a quite narrowed one, such as on this film here. Again, 15-degree craniate angulation optimizes getting the X-ray beam through the lumbosacral junction on the ventral dorsal view. And you see that for its true width then. Okay, any questions then about the routine standard arrangements? Comments, suggestions, any pet useful tips that you tell your techs you want to share with? Yes? Underneath the dogs, I prefer just wads of ball cotton. You can buy from X-ray supply companies foam pads like you've seen, that you can't see on radiographs, but you need to get them from an X-ray supply company. I suggest to you then you wrap them in plastic if you want to keep them so that you can't see them. Okay. Now some obliques. I already showed the first one, this 30 to 45 degree oblique image, and this is how you position it with, again, in this case we're using a foam pad that's of that shape, to do the same as we would do for the oblique of the middle ear, to again see the dens. So that's the trick. If you do that same down to 45 degrees, down through the lower portion of the cervical spine, you can for the first time see the intervertebral foramen as the holes they are on one particular side. So like to see them in the lumbar area, to see them in the cervical area, about a 45-degree oblique, will bring out one side. So transverse process is thrown down, labeled right on here. So this is a right lower ribs here, and thrown to the opposite side, the left side up here, which means you then need to turn the dog over completely and do the opposite if you want to compare the left versus the right intervertebral foramina. In a few dogs over the years, I found this a useful technique for diagnosing bone reabsorption secondary to a brachial plexus tumor. They're sometimes challenging diagnosis. Often they present with lameness as initially and other mobility type issues. Also, we've used ultrasound to image through these intervertebral foraminae and in a couple of cases found tumor masses which we've aspirated and biopsied through there, and that's been written up in the literature also to make that diagnosis, which is a first route to go before going for the more expensive imaging such as CT or even better still, MRI imaging. This is the radiographic projection then to look at one side and then turn to the other to look at the other. The trick for seeing the intervertebral foraminae in the lower thoracic area at the TL junction where we want to see them, because in chondrodysplasts that's a high location of disc prolapse, is about a 15 degree oblique. So it's like a crooked thoracic radiograph that you found where the set of ribs are thrown upwards and one set's down. And so when looking at a thoracic lateral, I always first check, is it truly lateral? And this is one of the ways I tell is there a set of ribs thrown up, because it's crooked. If you do that, you'll notice, oh, I can see through these black holes for the first time, and they're the intervertebral foramen then in the lower thoracic spine. So that's something else that might be useful for you. I just threw in this little image here of a puppy spine. You don't get to radiograph too many of these, fortunately, trauma-wise. But just to remember that these vertebrae actually have growth plates. The bodies have a growth plate at each end, and then a disc, and then another set of growth plates. And I expect them to be closed about 5 months of age, not to be visible anymore. But they do grow, just like long bones, from growth plates. They're just like long bones with Salter fractures. This is a weak point, and so a young dog hit by a car, I've seen a number of them having these M-plate fractures. And that's because of a weak place that the cartilage hadn't completely gone and the bone remodeled, and is a Salter fracture then format of the spine. And the C1-2 junction is a real mess. I said, bring me a puppy of the same age. I can't tell what I'm seeing here. And it's the same in foals too. There's a whole bunch of different growth plates. The dens actually has two. The body has multiple ones here. Here's a separate piece of C1. I guess I've not radiographed enough or made enough study to understand it yet. Traumatized patients. I have some special things that I driven to our students that go out to speak to the owner. And the first thing is, to approach as much as possible to duplicate the situation with trauma in people. And so we have what we call backboards. They are just plexiglass boards. We have a couple of different sizes. Here's a long one for a big dog and a smaller one that's about 3 feet long for a small dog. And we have some holes cut in them. And what we want the students to do is to carry them out to the owner's vehicle and slide them under the dog, with the paralyzation, which we suspect is from trauma, from some fracture, luxation. And so then they can lift the dog, and they've put some strapping on like this, as you see here, onto the gurney to wheel it into the hospital and do their exam on it. And we'll do laterals without anesthesia. If the animal will lay still, we prefer anesthesia again. If it's anesthesia, then we want them to lift it onto the anesthesia cart and table, again using the same board, to arrive then on radiology so that we can radiograph through this board and not see it. So that the board is lifted onto the table, not the animal repositioned for the fifth time and pulled and dragged. So laterals can easily be made that way, just as I've suggested. Ventrodorsal views, again, we're very insistent on being told about this being a suspect trauma fracture luxation, because we don't want to roll it on its back for the first time to make the radiograph. So we do it with a horizontal X-ray beam. The cassette is held vertically in a little upright holder there, so everyone can leave the room. The ventrodorsal views never look quite as picturesque as the ones I've shown you, made like this with a stationary grid, but they're They can still be diagnostic for the rotational instability that's present, so that we can then get the images that are necessary, work out where the luxation is, fracture component is, and if there's deep pain, get the animal into the surgery area so the only time it gets moved from the time it left the owner's vehicle is when it's lifted onto the surgery table into the position it needs to be for surgery. I think the worst possible thing is to come to radiology, have radiology twist and turn it in four different ways to get the routine radiographs and go from having deep pain to having no deep pain. That's worse than not making radiographs, you know. So this is our approach then, is to use radiolucent material. You can get from called plexiglass, you can get it from a hardware store or whatever, to radiograph through. And if any one of you are interested in doing myelograms and don't have a table that is able to tilt to encourage the contrast material to go where you want it to, this is a way also to do it, because you can then elevate one end of the board while you're doing the injection and then just lay it flat back on the table again to make the radiograph, and also position not the dog now with the needle in place, but by turning the board, position it parallel to the x-ray beam without then any risk of injuring the patient, because you're turning it on this flat surface all the time. So that's actually really close to good timing. Are there questions then that I can help you with relative to improving and getting nicer spinal radiographs? Okay. Thank you.